Oh my days. This is the 50th episode of Unearth You, and I am so excited for how far we have come. I'm especially proud of you, our listeners, for following through on the content, because without you, thank you for always coming through. If you're listening to this later than the month of May, this episode was recorded in May, the mental health month, and I thought it was only fair to have a mental health episode. With the leading cause of mental health disorders, I'm talking about the emotional kind of disorders traced to incidents like childhood abuse, trauma, neglect, loneliness, alcohol misuse, domestic violence, bullying, unemployment, and just really a host of others. Myself and my guest today talk about mental health illness in a very different way, right? We talk about the difference between mental health illness and mental health illness. You have to listen to know what that's about, how to identify and support loved ones through mental health challenges, how do you manage relapse, you know, red flags to look out for when you're choosing a therapist, men and therapy, and of course we talk about boundaries as well. This is such a wholesome episode, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed doing this. Happy listening.
Hi, I am Obakam Tom George, the quintessential host of Unearth You, the podcast. This podcast is your dose of inspiration that influences how you show up in the world and in relation to others. Please subscribe to the podcast in your podcast platform of choice. Rate the show, leave a comment with a 5-star review, whether you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening on. Feel free to also share some insights or whatever connected with you on social media, and tag us at unearth.you on Instagram so we can repost and share. Looking to support the podcast? Very easy. Drop us a tip on Shuklen. Link in the show notes. Let's get into the show. It begins at 3, 2, 1.
Thank you for choosing to do this with me, for accepting my invitation. Let's just get a bit of intro about you, who you are, what you do, and all that good stuff.
Okay, it's good to be here. Thank you for the invite. I am Adedoyin Ajayi, best known as Adedoyin. I'm a licensed psychotherapist with a specialty in emotional health. I'm also a co-founder of a mental health startup, mytherapies.ng, and the plan is to have a platform where everybody can have access to affordable and culturally sensitive services. So yeah, that's it about me.
Before we get into it, let's do a bit of rapid fire questions so that our listeners will know you a bit better, right? Okay. Socially. Okay. So yes, number one question for you. Your life is a work of art. If someone saw it hanging up in the museum, what would it look like?
It would be a very grand palm tree. Palm tree because it is a very versatile tree. I like the idea of my life represented as a palm tree because I consider myself as a shade that keeps people safe from the harshness of the climate, in this context, emotional climate. And there's just so much fruitfulness going on. There's a lot that can be gleaned from me.
I love it. The next one is, when you are not working, how do you like to spend your time?
I enjoy reading books a lot. The plan is to collect books. Eventually, I'm a bibliophile, proudly so. But at the moment, I satisfy my love for books by engaging in a healthy amount of voracious reading whenever I'm stressed, whenever I need to just get things off my shoulders. Another thing I do is watch very banal sitcoms.
I have two questions here out of this rapid fire asking what your favorite book is and what the last movie you watched is.
I don't have a favorite book.
Not as much.
Because that... But I do have seasonal authors I'm fascinated by from time to time. Books by Sophie Kinsella are still doing it for me. It's like this everlasting taste of goodness in my mouth. The last movie I watched, of course, I don't know if it qualifies as a movie. So I'll have to put that into two categories. The last thing I saw on my screen was Big Bang Theory, and rightfully so, because it's a sitcom.
Yeah,
but then the last movie I watched that's a proper movie would be Queen Charlotte.
Saw that as well. Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Okay, let's jump into this. I'm going to start with the story of when I was seven, right? NYC Diaries. this was in 2018. So on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I used to go to the hospitals and to the prison, some pro bono work, some fellowship work. It was just, I just found myself in the hospitals on Tuesdays and the prisons on Thursdays. A couple of friends and I go there, like pray. It was a fellowship thing anyway. We go there, pray, just speak to these people, like keep them company, you know, and all of that, right? So I was posted to the psychiatric ward. Mm-hmm. And I'd see people in chains who could not walk freely. They were tied to their beds. But I'll see some others who, you know, were free. I mean, women, men. The one that struck me the most, because I was a core member at the time, was this lady, this young girl who was in the psychiatric home. And she wouldn't talk to us. We'll get to find out eventually that the reason why she's there is because she had some issues in school. And at the end of it, I think she wasn't posted for NOIC or something. And her life just went on a downward spiral because her friends were going and she didn't get to go for NOIC. And then we'd come to the hospitals with our khaki, right? Mm-hmm. So anytime she saw us, it was like a trigger for her. And then I just wondered, like, why is she here with these people who have this level of mental illness? Hers was just like depression, according to what they had told us. But here she was, you know, she never wanted to speak to us. In fact, on a subsequent visit, we stopped wearing our khaki to come there just because of her, right? And so it made me realize that there is mental illness and there is mental illness. And in this part of the world, until people begin to start wearing rags and like eating off the dustbin, we still treat it like with kids' gloves, right? And my confusion is not helped when I see studies from like WHO saying that 1 in 4 Nigerians see some 50 million people are suffering from some sort of mental health illness, you know, right? And it's like, okay, what kind of mental illness are you talking about if you say 1 in 4 people? I mean, in my family, we're 6 in number. If you say 1 in 4 people, what does that mean, right? So I want you to like... just give us the clear-cut difference between mental illness and mental illness in the context that I just explained it. Is there really a difference? Can mental health issues like depression and anxiety be more fatal aside suicide? Just something to help us understand better what mental health is all about.
I love the context you laid, and it's going to help us to lay a very wholesome premise based on the question you asked. Okay? Mm. The first thing we need to understand is the fact that mental illness is a generic word that covers or encapsulates all the different anomalies of the mind. I'm going to approach this from a place of simplicity. Everything that functions has the propensity to malfunction. Okay, so as long as something is functional and is required to work or do certain expected tasks, that thing can also malfunction. And take, for example, a fan or a car. These are operational tools that meet our needs in certain areas. The same thing can be said of the human body and the human mind. Every aspect of the human body or the human mind is subject to malfunction as long as it is existing. Okay. So the word mental illness in the first place is just a simple case of mental malfunction. Something used to function, it is no longer functioning as optimally as it used to. Okay. Now, in the context of the difference between mental illness and mental illness, what it means is that there are two primary categories. And every other category falls under the two. The first category would be the neurocentric illnesses that have to do with the part of your brain that can be seen, dyslexia, autism, you know, ADHD, these neurodivergent illnesses. And then when we take it a little step further, lunacy, where you're either psychosis, schizophrenia, you know, these things are affecting your behavioral tendencies. It is affecting the way you live your life on a physical level. So we can recognize certain aspects of your brain that is responsible for these things. Oh, it's the prefrontal cortex. Oh, it's the amygdala. You understand me now? Oh, it's this part of the muscle of the brain that's causing this. Then we have the second dynamic, which is the emotion-centric illness. Now, these ones have to do with your feelings. They are abstract. So even though your brain is responsible, it is not direct and as straightforward as neurocentric illnesses. So we have things like depression, we have things like anxiety, mood disorders, everything and anything that involves your feelings. And so you can be very put together and filled with composure, but on the inside, you are a box of nerves and you are as equally ill as the person on the road. So these two major differences has created such a wide gap that it is impossible for the average mind to reconcile the fact that me, in the safety of my house, just because I have this disorder where when it's time to think about going abroad, my mind is shutting down, I'm panicking, I'm shaking, I don't want to climb the plane, and I'm supposed to be as ill as the person who's naked outside and living beside the refuse dump. It does not correlate. So there's a cognitive dissonance to that effect, but the difference is clear. And unfortunately, the society we live in has erroneously placed so much attention and spotlight on the neurocentric ones, the ones we can see. But the ones we cannot see that affect your emotions, the ones you can mask, get to receive lesser attention. And that exactly is where the differences set in, but they are both the same. They are both mind anomalies.
Flowing from this, what would you say is the growing cause of mental health related challenges in young people, especially the emotional part? Because I think that's what we are focusing on today, right? Mm-hmm. Is it that society is really broken, or did mental health issues exist before now and they've just been more amplified by social media?
So the truth of the matter is mental health has always been the norm, but we have a situation as well, and the situation is guilt by association. Back in the day, people went through different levels of emotional issues, but because there was no inkling as to what they were going through, everybody was able to hide under certain social politics to follow through. Okay, so it could be the social politics of going to church or belonging to a club or cultural norms. Look, this is how it is done. You gotta take it like that. You know, there was always something that was like an escape hatch for the issues that people faced back in the day. But now we live in a world where everybody's online and social media is such a leveler. And what you know, you can pass across to millions of people by just clicking a button on your phone and pressing record. Okay. So the difference now is all of those social politics that many people hid under as coping mechanisms have been stripped off and called out, and people now see them for what they are. People are now left to deal with the helplessness of the situation, because now you can say, I don't need to believe that it's just about prayer. Like, this person is apparently hurting my feelings and you're telling me I have to stay in this abusive situation where I'm being beaten by my husband and I have to just pray. No, I cannot do that. That's not proper. And so many people are like, oh, me too. Oh, really? You too? Wow. Abusive relationship, domestic violence. All of us together, we are all going through this. Oh my God. Oh my God. And then there's this collective agreement that we are all sick. Okay. So with the advent of social media has come a lot of awareness of these things. And then there's now been clearer and more realistic pointing out of this issue. So they've always been there. Social media made it public, but not just did it make it public, it also removed the previous escape hatches that people hid under that made it look like they were not going through these things. But trust me, disorders have always been a thing that was amongst us. And when I ask, when people say, oh no, it's not true, I ask, is this the first time you are hearing that a man is beating a woman? And when they say, oh no, not at all, what do you think will make a man in his right senses take his hand and beat a woman? Mind was functioning the way it should function. Do you think that looks proper? Is this the first time you see a man sitting outside in his house, not talking to anybody and staring into space? They say that is a harsh person. It was just a depressed man. He was going through life, but he didn't know it at the time. So the point is, those things that people could not call out before because they were like sacred conversations or untouchable conversations have become scrutinized, and now everybody knows them for what they are, and it has made it more common and more relatable. So yeah.
So I have two questions flowing from that about like stigma. And I see it as a trend. When someone takes their life through a certain way, other people start doing the same thing. For like a week, you just see that people start jumping, you know, the bridge. People start like, you know, taking their lives just like that. Do they see it as an option or someone has done it? So it's like something in the air. People just start taking that route. I don't know if you get my question.
Oh, yes, I do. Your question is it's kind of tied to the last question that I answered. Anything that has publicity opens up possibilities. Publicity is literally the power you wield over somebody's will and emotion. Now, I'm in the corner of my room thinking dark thoughts and not even permitting myself to go beyond certain thoughts because I've not even conceived the possibility and feasibility of carrying through with that dark thought. And then I stumble on your page and I see you doing it. What do you think that does for me? It motivates me. Yeah. So the thing is, again, guilt by association. In this sense, you are generating energy, but the energy is being generated by virtue of influence. So everybody is impressionable in varying levels. What you feed your spirit or your mind is going to create a specific and predictable behavioral outcome. Mm. So if you are online and you see that, okay, suicide is like becoming commonplace, everybody seems to be talking about it, and the person that died seems to gather and garner a lot of sympathy. And you know how people can be on social media when somebody dies, the set of GoFundMes for the family of the bereaved, everybody is feeling so sad and so emotionally subdued. Suddenly everybody's like, check on your friends, be kind, da, 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 da. So if you have the spotlight syndrome, you're like, oh, this could be me. At least I could make something good out of my life. If I die, somebody will see the reason to be kind. You know, my point is, it just creates counterintuitive PR for bad behavior. So publicity creates possibilities. That's just it.
All right. I get this now. Okay. My next question is speaking to identifying, understanding, and supporting people with mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to give one instance out of many. For instance, a loved one who is suffering from some sort of disability that they were not born with, an accident happens, they lose their legs, or they become blind, or anything really. They were not born this way. And so maybe 20 years into their life, I mean, they were 20 when this happened, they now have to live with this sort of disability, their self-esteem, their mental health, they all take the fall for it. How do you support them?
Okay. So number one, the way you support people that are going through life-changing situations or life-altering situations that has had a very huge impact on their mental health is to first come at it from a place of realistic empathy. Because everybody is quick to say, oh, put yourself in their shoes. But trust me, no matter how much you try to be empathetic about certain things, you genuinely cannot really put yourself in their shoes. Mm. Do you get me now? Yeah. So realistic empathy only happens when you are super curious. So instead of assuming that this is how they are feeling, you want to really know. You want to hear from the horse's mouth. So people who go through life-altering situations like that are people that you need to give your listening ears, all right? And that is why the job of a therapist in mental health practice is crucial. Medication is good, but talk therapy has proven to be absolutely effective because conversations is the window of the soul. When you talk, you open up yourself to certain aspects of your mind that you yourself were not aware was a factor. So when people are allowed to just express without fear of judgment, it does a lot for them. Unfortunately, we live in a world where people are so tone deaf that they want to do most of the talking and less of the listening. So to help people who are going through a lot, realistic empathy is going to be the way. How can I be there for you right now? Don't assume. Would you like to talk about this? No pressure. Okay. And to also understand that at the end of the day, certain aspects of care would always be left to some professional to handle, because no matter how much you care about this person, oh, there's only so much you can do realistically. Sometimes you want to lend a listening ear. You even know how to listen actively, but they are not in the place to talk. They are cognitively dissonant from the situation and they are repelling you. They are pushing you away. They are making you feel very unwanted. But it's not like they hate you. They are just not in that place. They are not there. And if it's not there, it's not there. So you want to be able to recognize what you can realistically do to help and what you need to do to hand over to who can help.
Have you ever come across clients that do not want to speak to maybe their family and they want to speak to someone they do not know at all?
Of course, that will always be a major feature. Again, the way the mind works is very interesting. And something about familiarity is that it dumbs down the value of the people around you. I mean, you know them, you know their quirks. So you most likely can tell how they would address or respond to your pain. And even when you know they mean well, you just know that they might not be able to come through. And that's because you are biased in your assessment of these people. But with a stranger, there is the grace that comes with blissful ignorance. A stranger is somebody's sister. But to you, this person knows nothing about you and you don't know nothing about them. And so it's easier for your mind to be less tense about the outcome. It's easier to trust because you have the benefit of the doubt that this person would not behave like your family members. Of course, this is not to say that every family member is just incapable of being a support system. It just is a sad truth that many times when we are in an emotional rut, the idea of speaking to family is not as appealing as speaking to someone that we don't necessarily know on a personal level.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the question of identifying people who are going through health challenges, because I've seen people who will be bubbly, they will be smiling everywhere, but they're going through the most. So how do you identify such people and help them out of it?
Just the same way many of them go around life bubbling is the same way it is difficult to identify. I tell people that emotional illness is the only type of issue that even the person helping you might have something to that they are dealing with. That is how delicate it is. That is how humbling it is. Do you get me now? So there is genuinely no way to find that. If anybody comes to you and tells you, oh, these are the signs, please signpost me to them so I can learn from them too. There's no way to find out. The only thing you can do is to work with the information available to you. So many times, everybody gets to a point where they crack. Their crack is what you can leverage on. They put on their status randomly out of the blue that, life, I'm not feeling suicidal or anything, but sometimes I just wish I could go into a coma for 6 years. I mean, come on. What else do you need to enter their DMs and say, bruv, are you okay? Are you good? You get me? Yeah, so it doesn't really require, it's not rocket science, honestly. If these people don't talk, there's no way you would know. So what you can only hope for is that they actually crack at a time where you could perceive it or could see it. So hopefully they post it somewhere, or there's just one day where they break down. And out of all the random experiences where they are like strong and always putting up a brave front, those little windows into their true predicament is what you have to leverage on. And I say that many times, it's not that these cracks don't happen. It's just we are all very blind to see it. How do you know somebody is cracking? Someone that is lively and very full of joy and exuberance is suddenly irritable. You know, taking a social media break for weeks, they are not online.
That's me.
Oh, Obakam, guilty as charged. Okay, interesting crack there. So you see, there was a cut.
Oh my God.
I'm glad you feel seen. So you see what I'm talking about. Yeah. You see, these cracks will always be there. So it's either people did not pay attention or they did not pay attention, because it is not possible for somebody to be going through the most and not crack from time to time. So that's just the little that we can use or leverage on to know when people are going through stuff.
So let's talk about dealing with relapse after healing from mental health breakdown. And like just knowing your triggers and how do you know that you have healed? Would you say you have really healed if you relapse?
When it comes to relapse, you've got to understand that relapse is always going to be contextual. There is relapse induced by triggers, all right? And that's why when you're going through a recovery process, if your trigger has not been addressed, it sometimes might be wasted effort. So you are in therapy because you have been in an abusive relationship, but you're still in that dynamic. You're still in the house where you have been beaten. What do you want your therapist to tell you, please? Because the moment you're done from therapy, the trigger is ready to undo every single thing. So relapse induced by trigger is real. And while it did not mean the person did not heal, it just means they did not give themselves the grace to be in an environment where the healing could be sustained, because everything has to be maintained. The first tip for maintenance is to avoid your triggers, or at least get away from your triggers until you're strong enough to, to assertively address them, okay? Then the second type of relapse is when the healing was just pseudo. Pseudo healing is where everything you're going through is imitating all the symptoms of healing. So it's euphoric. You are excited, you heard one or two things in therapy and you feel good, but you did not finish the course of your therapy sessions. So your therapist said, okay, you need 6 therapy sessions, but then after one session you felt so strengthened, everything feels good, the sky feels brighter, colors are shinier, everything just looks better, and then you go off therapy. It's like taking medications halfway. The malaria symptoms will come back stronger, trust me. Shall you get? So the truth is, if you are healed, you're truly healed. But healing is a journey, and you've got to pay homage to that journey, or else you'll break down halfway all over again.
All right, final question from my end before we take some of the audience questions. What are some red flags to look for when choosing a therapist? How do you know a therapist is good, is the right fit for you?
Okay, the first thing I need you to know is that you've got to trust your guts. Therapy is very much a talking business. And at the epicenter of a conversation is connection, okay? So I can assure you that if there's no camaraderie in this conversation, it would have become lilted by now. You will be the one eager to finish the podcast, okay? So every therapist must have a nice proclivity for rapport building. It should come naturally to you. People should feel at ease in your energy. So I tell people, you're talking to a therapist, but you feel detached. It feels clinical. It feels too processed. There's nothing authentic about the aura your therapist is generating. Run for your life, because this is the person you are entrusting the secrets of your heart to. If the vibe is not vibing, what are you doing? So never stay in a situation or a dynamic where you genuinely don't feel some level of connection. And I'm not saying that you need to feel sparks and rainbows in the sky when you're with your therapist. I'm just saying there should be this sense of assurance. This person can help me. There should be something about their voice, something about the energy they put forth that just makes you feel comfortable around them. It comes from a place of sincerity. No therapist can fake that. You can be the most brilliant therapist on paper, but you cannot fake rapport. You cannot fake genuine connection. You cannot. The second thing that you must note is if your therapist is literally breaching all the ethics. And that's why you have to know the ethics too. Ethic number one, your therapist is interrupting you. How? Where is that done? And this happens a lot. You get me? Where there are clients who come to therapy and tell me how their previous therapist used to interrupt them. So these are ethical clashes. They should not even be, you know, found. Number two, your therapist just has a very lackadaisical approach towards your issue. There's no sense of, what's the word now? There's no sense of diligence. You feel like you're just another patient. You get me? Of course, yes, you are another patient. But again, every case must be treated with the attention of exclusivity. You get me? So when your therapist makes you feel like you're just one of the number, and you will know, it will be glaring. You get me? So you want to feel like this person really cares about you. They map a blueprint for you, and it's clear. You get me? If there's no blueprint for your treatment, you're just gisting with your therapist. And that leads me to the fourth one. When the therapy is all about talking about your problems, there's no action point, there's no recovery metric, there's nothing to measure your growth by, there's no point. Even if you like their energy, even if you're connecting with them, they are not your friend. Your therapist is not your friend. And then the ultimate one is boundaries. Your therapist must have boundaries. So if your therapist makes you feel like you're their friend, or is oversharing with you, or is just pretty much saying unprintable things to you that would make you, they'll put you in a certain position emotionally, especially because you're the vulnerable one, then that's a huge red flag. So there are a lot, honestly, but off the top of my head, these are the ones I can come up with.
I love them. So I'm just going to go straight up into the audience questions. There are a lot, but I'm just going to take a few of them. This one says, society expects men to shoulder stuff and be stoic. So how can a therapist convince the average guy that letting it all out can be good for them?
I think convincing men to let it all out is counterproductive. And coming from a therapist, I know that sounds jarring, but it's the truth. Because society has taught you something, and a therapist comes from nowhere and tells you scientifically there's nothing wrong with letting it all out. It's contextual. Because the society is still the society. And so even when you decide to let it all out, the question is, who are you letting it out to? So mm-hmm. It is not so much about letting it out. It's about selective vulnerability. So I tell men, dipping your proverbial foot into the world or the water of emotional expression should come from a place of emotional literacy. You cannot be vulnerable with every Tom, Dick, and Harry. You want to be able to see that this person is mature and objective enough to not stereotype you. So if you want to break free of that stereotype, and the person you are being vulnerable with is still being held bound by that stereotype, then the whole process is a wasted operation. So we don't want to encourage men to be vulnerable when the society or the people in their lives can still not handle it. What I advise now is, yes, scientifically it has been proven that the same tear glands that women have is the same one that men have. So men tear glands don't have not for use on it. It is meant to be used because it is supposed to create catharsis. When you cry, catharsis is experienced. It is good for your mental health. It helps you to release those toxins that has accumulated because of the pain. Number two is emotional expression helps you to actually declutter. So what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If a woman finds peace from doing it, imagine the peace you would find too from doing it, the same type of peace. So what you want to do is not just cry, not just shout, not just give into your feelings indiscriminately. Protect yourself by doing it only with people that you feel comfortable with. So even as we all advance towards collective enlightenment, identify people that genuinely make you feel comfortable in your vulnerable state. I'm so glad that we have a lot of emotionally literate individuals out there, both men and women. So if you, for example, contextually, you're with a partner that is pro, please cry. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Your crying does not make you less of a man. Go ahead, by all means, indulge in this bliss. But if you're with somebody that's also always saying things like, oh, I believe men that cry are weak. And for other reasons that outweigh her cons, you like her, want to be with her. I don't think there's any point to crying. Like, do you get the point now? So I'm just coming at the conversation from the place of reality, because I've heard a lot of guys say, you guys will say we should cry. Okay, now we are crying. You are telling me I am weak. What do you want me to do? So we don't want two truths to not coexist. Two truths can coexist. It's okay to cry, but it's okay to cry or to express your feelings and be vulnerable only with those that can validate you.
Take two more questions. This one says, therapists, especially in Nigeria, can often cross the line between their profession as being like Christian guidance counselors. Some people find it off-putting. How do Christian therapists navigate this? I don't know if it's a therapist that asked this question, a Christian therapist, but yeah. I don't know if you get the question. Should I take it again?
No, I get you. Completely get you. In as much as we all like to be very progressive in our thinking, we need to be down to earth. Sometimes we need to touch grass. We live in a very culturally sensitive climate. And in this cultural climate, religion is one of the prevalent themes. Your therapist came from this climb as well, and it is taking a lot of unlearning for many of them to shift their mindsets to cosmopolitan therapy services. I am a cosmopolitan. I have been a long time ago. I have my exposure to thank for that. It's not that your therapist is not professional. It just means they recognize the fact that your spiritual background might be playing a huge role in the way you think. So trying to dissect it is just going to be toxic progressiveness. So what I do now is ask for ethical consent, because it will be very off-putting too for somebody who genuinely wants faith-based therapy, and I'm just there pretending like I'm not hearing them say things like, oh, I used to be a prayer warrior, but now I no longer pray, and I'm like, sorry, we cannot discuss religion here. Am I okay? I have to be culturally sensitive. This person is apparently talking about it because something about them resonates with this part of their lives. Yeah, it's okay to drop hot takes on Twitter, but when we come to the nitty-gritty, most times it is the client that is raising the issue themselves. So what do I do now? I ask, and that's what I'm going to always recommend. Never allow your therapist to impose their views on you. That is where you should draw the line. Number two, ethical consent. Okay, hi, Obakam. I noticed you just mentioned something about your spiritual life, and I would like to know if I have your consent to delve into that. Would you like us to talk about certain dynamics of your faith? Oh, by all means, please dig in. You know, it's consent, and you got to sign. I make sure they sign. Sign here. Your name here, my name here. It's not be your word against mine. Never will I do that. So even though I'm a faith-based therapist, I have queer clients, I have atheists, I have agnostics, and I respect everyone because I'm a cosmopolitan. It's a service I offer. I'm about your mental health. So consensually, I am not permitted to impose my views. Okay, but if you genuinely bring it up, it means something within you is craving to talk about it. And what I would do is ask you outrightly, and if you agree to it, we sign an agreement. Agreement is agreement. Agreement never lies. So yeah, that right there is what I call the healthy balance. That's it.
We're going to take the last question. Is it the therapist or patient's fault if my condition worsens?
It could be a mishmash of both. It could be one of the two. No two cases are the same. Effective therapy is usually a product of healthy collaboration between the two parties. Your therapist cannot work alone. Neither can you. If there is a relapse or there's no results from your sessions, you would be able to tell where the problem is at. But it's always either one or the two. So you as the client might not be mentally ready for or ready to get help. So maybe somebody paid for your therapy sessions and you're doing it to make them happy. Okay. Your mind is not postured to receive the help your therapist wants to offer. The vibe is there and it is eating deep into the productivity of your sessions, or you're being given tasks and assignments and you're not doing them. What do you want your therapist to do? Or it could be your therapist's. Red flags everywhere, all the things we aforementioned, and you are still in therapy with that kind of therapist. Please, what do you think would happen? Nothing. Okay, it could be the both. The therapist is exhibiting red flags, you are cognitively dissonant. All of these things can play a huge role, but the most important thing is to be perceptive. Okay, so instead of trying to cast blames, oh, what went wrong, just assess the situation. Is this working for me? If your answer is no, switch immediately and gets help elsewhere. So yeah,
thank you. I mean, we've said a lot of things today, a lot of very interesting stuff today. I love to ask this question to my guests, just to be sure, what is that one question you wish people asked you more?
How are you doing? Genuinely, how are you? That's all.
Oh, how are you? Wow, I mean, you take on so much. Like, I don't know how you therapists are able to, like, you know, just compartmentalize, like, okay, this is not my life. How do you deal with vicarious trauma? I mean, I'm not asking that question now, but I'm just like, wow. You guys listen to a lot of these stories, and I'm just wondering how you deal, really. So, yes, guys, if you want to get into Adedoyin's heart, ask her, genuinely, that's the key word there. How are you doing? Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Before you go, can you drop your social media handles? Are you working on any projects that you might need support, you know, with from our audience?
I am at Adedoyin Ajayi on social media, all social media platforms at Adedoyin Ajayi. Like I said, I'm the co-founder of mytherapies.ng. So one of the things you can do is to spread the word. Therapy is affordable and accessible. We have created a therapist bank, so you have access to a plethora of different therapists with different specialties, and these therapists are well vetted. So you want me to feel fulfilled? You want me to feel like I'm doing something right? Download mytherapist.ng app. Follow us on all social media platforms and fund your wallet. And
yay.
Therapy as cheap as 3K. I mean, how good is that?
Wow, really? Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. I feel like I would do a competition, I don't know, and, you know, gift some people for this therapy thing, right? You just tell mm-hmm. me why you think you need it, you know, and let's see how that goes. You remember the time I asked you about, like, if you offered child therapy services?
Yeah.
This friend in Ireland had this teenager friend, mm-hmm. or teenager cousin, I think, who was going through a lot. And I think therapy in Ireland is, like, really expensive. So he was asking if I knew anyone who offered therapy to teenagers. The therapist you have under my therapist, do you have therapies that speak to teenagers now?
Yes, that's the beauty of it. We
okay.
do.
Okay, cool. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for spending your 1 hour with us. I'm very grateful.
You're welcome.
And that's it. We've come to the end of today's conversation. We'd definitely love to hear your feedback. You can do so by dropping us a DM on Instagram at unearth.u or a voice message through the link in the show notes. I'll see you on the next episode. Signing out.